Have you ever wanted to be an inventor? Most kids do, but as they quote-unquote grow up, being an inventor sounds childish. Nathan, however, found a way to be an inventor, but in an unlikely way. He designs playgrounds, but not just any playgrounds. Earthscape is the playground design company Nathan works for, and he has found designing playscapes within its said context takes quite a bit of imagination and inventing. His passion stems from childhood, as he watched his grandfather work in the woodshop. This strikes a chord with me. That means that someone in his life sparked enough curiosity to bring him to where he is today. Nathan reminded me that being a kid is not just a phase or an age group. It's about having fun and loving what you do. I don't know about you, but I really need that reminder sometimes. Now, cozy up with your favorite cup of tea and listen in on my interview with Nathan Schlecker. So thanks so much, Nathan, for joining me in our conversation. So I actually don't know you that well. I just went right up to you after your session at the ASLA conference in Nashville in 2021. And I was like, hey, come on my podcast. It'd be great.
So why'd you do that?
Yeah. So why did I do that? It's a great question. So let me tell you a story. I started my thesis and it was about play, and I always have been so interested in the idea of play and what it means and what it is and how to design a playground for children. And I was so intrigued by your session because you talked about how these sort of concepts kind of contribute to play theory.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if this is your quote. I have it here, but it was playgrounds are places where children thrive, where imaginations run wild, where bodies and brains are engaged. They are places of stimulation, socialization, excitement, joy, and wonder. They're spaces that build community. I'm not sure if you wrote that, but I have that in my notes.
Okay. I don't know if I said that or not either.
It's a great quote, but I feel like it encapsulates everything that you were kind of talking about for your session.
Yeah.
So could you give the audience a little bit of like a synopsis of what you talked about?
Well, yeah. So the session was with three speakers, and my role on the panel was to try and be the bridge between the two others. And so one was talking about a project from a project management standpoint in Saskatchewan. It was a World Heritage Site kind of place, really, really unique and especially important for Indigenous peoples. And the other person was a landscape architect that worked on probably the most ambitious greening project in Detroit in many years, called the Joe Louis Greenway. And both of those projects have one of our playgrounds that I worked on the design. The theme of the whole session was about storytelling and storytelling through design. And so I got to kind of thread that needle between those two very, very different projects by talking about the incredible stories that were being told through the play design and the play experience. So that's a little bit of a cliff notes of what we talked about that day.
Very cool. Yeah, I loved it. And I think the one thing that kind of drew me in was the word storytelling. Obviously with the podcast, it's very much what I'm trying to do. So it was very cool to kind of see how you, like you said, you were threading those kind of stories together. So you work for Earthscape as a playground designer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how long have you been there?
So I moved almost 5 years ago. I moved from Detroit, and I'd been looking for something like this for a long time. So ever since I graduated school, you know, I had done projects that were almost every semester I was doing projects that had to do with the idea of play and learning in many, many different forms. And one of those forms was an outdoor playground space. And my background is in industrial design. So, you know, it was products mostly, but then this idea of doing a whole space, that was sort of like mind blowing to me. And like, obviously not to most landscape architects, because that's what you do.
Yeah, right.
But to me, it was like, oh, like the whole space could be what I designed too.
That's true.
And not just the things in it. And so that was got me really excited. And so I started off doing more trade shows and exhibits and, you know, museum spaces, things like that for a while. And then you skip a few years. I kind of played music and did other non-design things for a while. And then came back and started my own company, making like playrooms and things like that. And so, and that's when I was like, this is, I spent about 10 years like kind of figuring out what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, no, this is for sure what I want to do. I want to be a playground designer. Wow. So that's how I found Earthscape and convinced them to hire me. I didn't realize that they were so small at the time. Uh-huh. Like, you know, call up the owner and I'm like, I just want to come, like, you know, work for free for a couple of weeks. Could you just to learn about the industry? And he's like, no. You know, they only had like 10 people in the company. Wow. At that point, but they'd already accomplished some like world-class million-dollar playgrounds.
Yeah. Wow.
And so I kept bugging him, and it took 2 years, but I eventually is like, no, this is really where I want to be, and you need to give me a shot. Wow. So he finally did, and here I am in it, and it ended up being a wonderful fit and absolutely exactly what I hoped it would be.
I would imagine it sounds like it. And I was there are so many things in there that I want to, you know, kind of draw out and look into, but it's interesting because your background in industrial design and then designing playscapes, you know, kind of all melts together at Earthscape there. It just kind of feels like that melting pot where you get to tackle so many things all in one place. And I never thought about that as a playground, as like everything you've ever wanted, really, like you've ever wanted to design is kind of right there in that space.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another job that I did during that like 9 or 10 year, like not doing formal design was working with kids. Like, yeah. I just never wanted to have a job where I had to feel like I had to be serious. And
yeah, man,
so darn grown up.
Yes. Oh, I relate with that. Now it makes me feel a little guilty because I started with my whole college career wanting to do early childhood education. Mm-hmm. And I was discouraged from it just because at the time it was like, this is too much. You're not going to have fun. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I got to have fun. So, but I regret it. And there's always been sort of this pull back to wanting to do that, because you're totally right. It's just, there's something about it that just brings magic and joy back into your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. It really is wonderful to, when different parts of your passions and your life kind of can converge. And
yes.
And then if you can actually make a living off of that, that's wonderful.
That is ideal. Yes.
Yeah.
So you started with industrial design as a, did you get a degree in industrial design?
Yep. I went to a design school called the College for Creative Studies in Detroit. And they are definitely most well known for auto industry, like just feeding the auto industry with like amazing talent. Like that is there, they just churn out incredible designers for the big three and more. But they also have a fantastic product design, which is sort of all the other things from your computer to your furniture, you know, all that stuff could fall underneath that umbrella of industrial design.
Mm. So you, what intrigued you to do that, to do industrial design specifically? And I see a lot of that in your sketches too. Like in your sketches, you give that sort of detail and that sort of style to your sketches too.
Well, I always wanted to be an inventor and but chemistry never really clicked for me.
You don't hear that every day. I've always wanted to be an inventor.
I always wanted to be an inventor. I just wanted to like make stuff up and create.
Right.
and put it out there in the world. So that's where it was. And so I considered engineering and I considered architecture. I considered a number of things. I didn't actually consider landscape architect, but I think I would really love to have gone down that path. Yeah. I just wasn't on my brain when I was, 17 and having to make that choice.
Right. Right.
But I discovered industrial design because of the car stuff there. There's a big, auto show in Detroit every year. That's where all the concept cars happen. And I saw the concept cars, and then I saw the sketches of people kind of coming up with the concept car next to it. And I can't believe that in 17 years, I'd never put it together. Oh, that's someone's job to dream these up. Like, one person.
Yeah.
Kind of started this whole train of events that led to that car over there. And so, mind blown. And so I figured out what that person was called, is industrial designer. And I decided, okay, that's pretty close to inventor. Let's do that.
I never thought about it that way. Yeah. It's pretty close to an inventor. Yeah. That's very true. And before then, did you grow up sort of wanting to create and design things? Were you encouraged to do that a lot? Where did that sort of passion stem from, do you think, to be an inventor?
Yeah, I think it was just seeing both grandpas were woodworkers. And I think when you're little, I mean, I'm still fascinated by woodworking. But when you're little, that's just sort of magic to take like a blank piece of timber and then convert that into a toy or some other thing. And then there's always sort of more of an artistic bend to my interests as well. Really, really loved learning about art history. And that's like my best way of understanding the past is through the artist's eyes. And then that turned into like design history past and all that. So somewhere between like the little tiny wooden toys my grandfather's did and then like just the interest in the arts and the design, they all sort of kind of converged eventually.
So. Wow. That's incredible. So your grandfather's plural.
Yeah. They were both pretty creative guys. My dad's dad was a pastor, but he had two garages and one of them was a full workshop. And that was, that was the magical space. That's where he, I think, really just sort of had his Zen moments. And that's where I kind of connected with him too. I was so little, but I understood that there was something really cool happening in there.
Right. Absolutely. That's usually always like the woodworker's sort of shop is like where the magic happens. So I can imagine for you, like as a kid, sort of being in that sort of playground, right? That's like a new, another version of a playground where there's things being made. Mm-hmm. So I can see now, like I can see the little tiny Nathan, going in there, wanting to be an inventor and seeing the, things being created after that. So that's really cool. And so I actually read an article that you wrote through LinkedIn, and it was talking about like the global pandemic impact through playground design. And you mentioned your dad, and you mentioned a quote from your dad, from Martin Luther: "Even if I knew that tomorrow the world would go to pieces, I would still plant my apple tree." Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. And you said that you and your dad had unpacked that. And I'm wondering if that has a significance to you growing up.
I think there's just an optimism in the face of whatever hardship might be going on in that idea of like acting with the aim to make the world better, to look to the future. One of the reasons why I switched from pursuing like exhibit design and trade shows was really this choice to find a branch of design that was really ecologically conscious, that was really making a difference to people, and especially young people, which was always the idea of play and learning was always what got me going. And I think that every time that I have an opportunity to contribute to a community, I think of that almost like planting a seed. And I'm not necessarily going to be able to know what that grows into. And that's sort of the beautiful thing is hopefully it you know, it's experienced by so many people that there's so many just sort of tree moments that grow from that. Part of that 10-year span was really understanding that what I wanted to do also needed to be meaningful.
Mm. So in this 10-year span, you said that you did something other than industrial design and design related things, right?
Yeah. Well, I was playing music. I was a youth worker. I was doing some freelance stuff here and there. Mm. And you know, I was really kind of excited about writing music, and that's where my creative brain was mostly occupied with. And it's funny, as soon as I moved here and started being like the lead concept generator guy at the company, I just sort of didn't pick up the guitar, and it was fine. Like, I didn't miss it. Like, it was just right. Like that, yeah. That brain space.
Yeah.
Got channeled into something else, and it was still fulfilled, even though it came out in a different form. Yeah. I don't know. I think I'm just sort of all in on concept design and play design. And I think that's a good thing.
It sort of plays into that. Yeah. I think that playing music and what you were trying to do, I guess it sounds like you're getting in that world constantly, is like working with kids and being a creative person, but you also had to do what a kid does, right? Like, what a kid does is just live freely and do whatever their heart is contented to do, and pick up an instrument, throw mud at someone's face, or trip over something, or things like that. And it's the same, like, I guess, you know, with you, like, you're trying to pick up those things that whatever your heart is contented to do, which is music, you know?
Yeah. I think after college, I was actually a little burned out. So I went right into like a pretty serious, you know, job where I, you know, the 9-to-5 thing and it was occasionally pretty long hours and it's more or less a cubicle kind of a set context. And,
yeah.
And I just wasn't happy. So, you know, I think there was a little bit of that return to being a kid thing to for a while, and that was definitely my opportunity to really figure out what I wanted to be and do.
This is kind of the stage where I think most students would probably benefit from hearing from maybe even what you have to say, because the idea that I think a lot of people have in their mind is everyone's so burnt out from school, everyone's so burnt out from pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and giving it everything they have. And then that 9-to-5 looks really good, because you're like, oh, I'm finally going to be able to rest. I'm finally going to be able to just have a work-life balance, you know, and go wake up, go to work, go home. It's going to be great. And I didn't think about that. Like, as a creative person, you might get bored with that.
Yeah.
So I
think you're right. Like, I think there is that sort of relief of you can shut it off. Like, I would imagine your experience isn't too dissimilar to my school experience, but I wasn't probably mentally the healthiest person by the end of school, because I was just so stretched thin after 4 years of like at least one all-nighter every week. Like, that's how intense it was. And and so you get this 9-to-5, and it does almost feel like a vacation, but I think it might have been where I landed, and the fact that I was maybe motivated to find something that was salary stable and all those things. Like, maybe I should have been a little bit more patient and giving myself a little bit more time before jumping into my first job. I think I was worried that there would be a window that would close if I took some time. And so I just jumped into the first decent offer that I got. So I think that there is something about giving yourself a little bit of space and patience after graduation. That's really important. And, you know, there, I don't regret it though. And I think that most people will give the same advice, that the first job doesn't have to be your dream job, that it's really about giving yourself a year or two of good experience that will open up, you know, options for you in the future. And that right. That's true. Like, it's really hard to find a job posting that isn't must have 3 to 5 years of experience. Like, well, where do you start?
Yeah, exactly. You're really looking for the 0 to 1 year experience.
Yeah, yeah. Come on, who's hiring that job?
Right.
Like, exactly. Nothing that shows up.
Barely anything at all. It's the scraps, yeah. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I get that that's just like the nature of things, that sometimes you have to take a ho-hum gig for a little while.
It's challenging to think that way, because if you're somebody who is sort of a go-getter, who is like, who just wants to, you know, keep moving and keep going, you tend to believe that those ho-hum freelancing kinds of things are like, okay, those are just going to be time wasters. I can't do those things. I need to get a job and do the things and blah, 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 blah. But in reality, it doesn't always have to look a certain way.
No.
Right.
And I think there's also just like, for retrospect on like my path, there's like that all the paths will converge eventually. And I think it's just about like giving yourself some patience with that, and like, right. And giving yourself an opportunity to explore a few different paths, because I think that that's, as long as you're okay with change and taking on that change, you're eventually right. gonna land where you need to go. Where you right. need to be.
Oh yeah, that's great. Being okay with change. Yeah, that's so true. So you were in your 9 to 10 year gap, right?
Yep.
Pursuing music and volunteering and working with kids as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in that 9 to 10 year gap, what happened then after that? What made you want to then switch into something more 9 to 5?
Well, there wasn't any one thing. I felt like it was just time to move on to the next thing. And I knew what that thing was because of a lot of soul searching and deciding like my job has to be meaningful. It has to have to do with kids. It has to be playful. So then I worked on gathering up a group of companies that were out there doing what I want to do. Some of them were exhibit designers. Some of them were children's museums that had in-house design departments. And some of them were playground designers. And I just started reaching out to people, people that were willing to talk with me. I would just sort of introduce myself. I went to a few conferences just independently, sort of like the ASLA, but I also did like one for science and children's museums and
wow.
things like that. And I just... I started to build that network up, and it took some time. I spent a couple of weeks sort of like as a guest fellow for this organization in Philadelphia. So there was like an investment, like it was a cost to do all of this. Wow. But there's also like in playground designers, there can't be more than a couple hundred playground designers in the world right now. Like it's like you have to work at it to like find those gigs. So. I eventually, you know, connected enough dots so that was one thing that was happening was all of that really creative networking, you know, that couple weeks in Philadelphia where I volunteered for a community design organization. They were architects and landscape architects that their whole thing was bringing people together to do pro bono work for youth centers and churches and businesses that were maybe couldn't pay for a professional services. They would kind of bring in professionals to do pro bono stuff. So they were happy to have me come mm-hmm. and that was the kind of things I was doing. At the same time, I also joined a makerspace. I don't know if you're have a makerspace at your school or
I don't know what that is. Do you mind defining what that is?
So it's a
sounds cool.
It is cool. It's basically a bunch of different kinds of prototyping shops all together. You can join. It's like joining a gym you join access to get access to the you know, the laser cutter, the wood shop, the metal shop, the CNC equipment, mm-hmm. the robotics equipment, the whatever. You join with a membership to all those things, and you have to kind of qualify to be trained on different things if you want to use those different shops. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and that made it so that I could actually design build for people. So I started to design build spaces for the Detroit Science Museum. I just kept knocking on the door, like, hey, I want to build stuff for you. And like, what do you have? And, you know, I was dirt cheap because I was desperate.
Yeah.
So then I got to like design some exhibits and some play spaces and things there. Wow. And then I designed a really nice, like, indoor play space for a church. That really kind of took off as like a community space. And I think that between those two things, that's what, you know, I was able to then show to Earthscape, and they were like, okay, this guy's like really motivated.
Legit.
He's just, and he's legit. He's probably a good find.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
It worked out.
Wow. You've said exhibit space or,
exhibit design?
Yeah, exhibit design. Yes. Can you describe what that is? I'm curious.
Well, I mean, when you go to ASLA, like all those booths, some of them are designed by an exhibit designer, like the biggest ones. Mm-hmm. And so it's the furniture of the space that would be somewhat like custom to that company, so that the whole space becomes a branded thing. So that's one, like trade shows is one part. The other part might be retail environments. That's kind of falls under, it's related to exhibits. So, you know, stores, the interiors, or the museum spaces, which is what I was most excited about, you know, designing those exhibits and those experiences. There's like a cross between user experience kind of things that go into it.
Yeah, that is kind of a little bit of a taste of what a playground is, right? Or at least of what you guys do at Earthscape, because you guys are basically creating these amazing sculptures that you get to interact with and play with, but that also from the outside look very, very cool. So it's somewhat of an exhibit, right?
I suppose so. Like we're trying to, like, I don't know if any one of our structures is something that you can pin down, but I would say that we're trying to blur the lines between playground architecture, landscape architecture, and art. Like somewhere between those things is like all of our projects need to sort of have a flavor of those four genres. And that mash, like whenever you mash up two different things, you get something new. And that's like been the creative process for it, you know, music, for anything, for ages. Just right. Just take two different things and combine them. Right. And so we're really, that's, and I think trying to be a little bit more architecturally ambitious with playgrounds, like that in itself would be a great mashup, you know, but then also thinking about how landscape architecture, and don't just give it a little postage stamp, like let the topography be part of the experience of the play. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just opens up so much, to start thinking about those kinds of things. And, and then, yeah, if you have something that is on par with a piece of really cool public art sculpture that you can't play with and play on, like, yeah. then you're really onto something.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's incredible. Is just having all those, like you said, all those flavors. And it's very visible in what you guys do. What project would you say encapsulates that, like, to the T that you've worked on?
I don't have, I think they all do.
Yeah.
I think there's just like a scaling. And the wonderful thing about doing, you know, custom work is there is a context-based approach always. And so, there's an opportunity to be informed by the stories of the space, the heritage of the people there, or the industry of there, things like that. And so that's that starting point, I think, is 100% in line with what landscape architects really like. I don't think most landscape architects are interested in making spaces that are like, you know, this could be Miami or this could be Toronto. It doesn't matter. Like, it's just the same. Like, no landscape architects is like wants to make cities feel the same from one to the next, I don't think. And I think playground designers should really start thinking more like that. Like,
right. Yeah.
Let's make the playgrounds and the fit the uniqueness of the park. Because obviously landscape architects care. They want this park to feel like Miami or this or like Toronto or Detroit. They want it to fit with that the character of those spaces and be nourishing places for the people there. Why the heck are all the playgrounds the same? Let's let the place inform the play as well.
So why is storytelling so important to, why is a story important to tell in a playground specifically?
Well, I think there's also a question there that maybe is between the lines, which is, I think there's always an important thing to have a story through the design process. And sometimes I think that it's okay if the playground doesn't necessarily tell that same story at the end. And I kind of love it when the story isn't so structured that it's obvious and it needs to, like, it doesn't have to have a knock you over the head kind of effect. So I think it's the story informs the design, and then the design can be a new story in itself, or it could tell that same one. And I think that is, using the word story is just another way of saying, like, this is something that is that resonates, that has a feeling and an impact beyond this is a slide, this is a monkey bar. This is, you know, this is something that becomes a launching point for connections of people to the space. There's so many reasons why that's important. You know, if you love a space, you're going to take care of it and it becomes a more sustainable space. If you love a space, you're forming strong connections and bonds and emotions to that space. You might, if you find joy in that space, you might want to stay in that town instead of, you know, everybody going to this, you know, to New York City or whatever. If you love your park or your playground, you know, people are going to want to live there and build community and build connections to each other. So I like, there's, it's just a playground. Like, I get that, but I also think that there's so much like connectivity, yeah, that can start from that space.
I love that. Through that storytelling, you're using that to inform the design, but then also it will automatically create a connection to anybody who utilizes that. And I think playgrounds are a part of life, like parks are a part of life, and it does really make an impact on how you live and how you decide to live. And I mean, I would even imagine too, for kids, for our families, parents, they're thinking about what their kid loves and what they love to do and where they love to go. And it would make a huge impact if all they ever did was go to this one park. They're going to be able to have that in their mind being, oh my gosh, this park in Canada was amazing. And it just had this Trojan horse, or it had, you know, these giant things. I saw one on your website where it was a beet, like, you know, like these things are very, almost like iconic and very site specific that it won't be able to replicate anywhere else. So yeah, it creates that tie to that. Now especially through the session, there was a lot of really good information on just analysis and research, which is really important to how we do things, and especially in school. For you, how do you guys approach that, that, you know, sort of analysis and research into the heritage of the site?
I think it's probably the same, in that we're doing a combination of the Googling of things to the yeah. interviews with people, to the engagement, the community. I think those kind of three branches really capture a lot. We've been known to call up, local professors and, you know, what to discuss what are the local flora, fauna, in this part of Central Ohio, and then right. come back to the landscape architect and the client group. Okay, this is what we found.
Right.
And we've narrowed down this cool list of creatures down to like three things, and this is what they might look like. And
very
that's
cool.
that's totally like a normal process. I don't think it's crazy. It's just making sure that there's space in the design process to do that research and that thinking, that can be tempting to skip, but it's so important.
Yeah. It almost feels, overwhelming, at least for me, like when I look into the research and analysis of the site, but it's as simple as you described it. Really. yeah, I wish I had that. I did not expect that. I thought it was like going to be this in-depth process and all these, you know, different, but it's just, it's literally that. Googling yeah. community engagement and, you know, historical history, you know.
Yeah, just talking to people is such a big thing.
What is one of your favorite ones to design and why?
Well, you mentioned the beat, so let's talk about that one.
which is, there's a music video attached to that,
which
we get to see your musical skills. so
the beat was funny because I really wanted to avoid working on that project at first, but yeah, because you know it came in and my work friend was like, you know, we've got this project. They want us to design a sugar beet themed playground. And I was just like, out the door. I don't want to do this. Like, there's no way that I can save that idea. Like, this just sounds, I was like, I don't.
Why?
Yeah, why?
Why?
I was so judgmental and hard on this beet idea. I just couldn't think of.
You do giant insects and boats and things, but not a beet.
There's no clear path to like make it not corny.
Right.
But they had, the city of Fort Collins had, a reason for it. This was like this is the industry that sort of made Fort Collins like a city, the city that it is. It was a really big deal. And the park where it was, they, wanted to pay homage to the fact that it used to be the site of this big sugar beet factory. And so there's the, you know, the storytelling is the seed of the storytelling is the history of the industry and migration to the place where all the workers and et cetera, Fort Collins, you know, started around a sugar beet, apparently. So, and so I was like, okay, well, like, I guess there had to have been a reason. They wouldn't just randomly ask for sugar beet.
Right. It has some significance.
That's cool. And then we also have brought in a local artist. We want them to have input on the creative process. And like, all right, that's kind of cool too. All right. So we started swapping sketches back and forth, and the beats like started to like look more and more fun, like to play on. And And it became one giant beat over time. And it's sort of like the, you know, what's there's a children's book where all the giant vegetables start flying through the air. Anyways, it was that kind of thing. And I started feeling like, okay, I think this is actually going to be kind of a magical like structure or play space for kids. Like, I think I'm pro beat.
Wow. You're pro beat.
Yeah.
Transition.
So I made the transition.
Night and day.
And I just embraced the absurdity of it and until it kind of became really cool. The idea of it, like it's they top the beat, and so it's sliced, and that was part of the conversations. They talked about the, you know, they had a black and white picture of like these probably underaged workers like topping beats. And that's got to be part of the story,
right?
And yeah, it just kept growing and growing as the story kept growing. So,
wow.
But so that was a very fun project. But there's some other things that I thought were kind of neat about it is that there's actually some like artistry to the shape of it. There's some artistry to the fact that we have just some little details that make it in. Sort of special. Like there's, if you look at the side profile, there's a little bit of a counter motion of cladding moving through the space through the structure, and that was actually kind of hard to make. Like the wood didn't naturally want to like flow in that way,
right,
over the structure, but that kind of those kind of little details made it really attractive and not just this kind of bulbous thing. Root veggie,
right?
So and then just like being really silly, like there's the hairs at the bottom of the beat that's like when you pull it out, and so we had turned that into like sliding bars and turning bars and monkey bar type things, and we call them nose hairs from the very get-go. And just like again, I'm in a job where I don't have to be serious, and right. So I had to
why not call them nose hairs, you know?
So I think that was a good lesson for me in reminding myself that that takes things so seriously. Like you can still have, you can still do something that's kind of cool and silly, like super silly.
Absolutely. You're allowed to do that. Wow. Mm-hmm. Very cool. I didn't expect that, especially from a sugar beet. I mean, I figured that it would have like a significance, but then even down to the cladding and then to the nose hairs, you know, like all of it is important, and all of it is integral to telling the story. So that's really neat. And what made you guys want to do a music video? Because was it the play on the word beat? Was it?
It was, yeah. Like I think that whenever I sent out like an email blast, I would do something like, just beat it, or we've got the beat, or what I would just try and refer in like sort of a dad joke kind of way,
right,
to the project. And so finally I think I convinced the project manager to like do a jam session. Like we started doing jam sessions during lunchtime.
Wow.
And we started learning all of the beat songs, and then someone said, wow, you should just record that. That's funny.
That was great. That was really great. It added some flavor to the playground design. And it also kind of showed like, wow, you guys really love your jobs. You guys are really happy at your jobs. You're really good at your jobs, and you're also having fun. Like this almost seems too good to be true. So it's hard. It's like as a student, that's all you're looking. That's like the eyes that you're seeing. Everything is like, where is the good jobs and where can I find, you know, joy in these things. And so that was pretty cool, at least from my perspective. So yeah. And I think also what you guys are doing at Earthscape, this ability to straddle between this structural and organic, and then also telling stories and doing all of that. I mean, that is very hard to find, I guess. And it I think people describe it as very niche, right? Because it pulls in all these different design industries. but it really should be the language of every landscape architect or even an architect. And mm-hmm. so I think what you guys do, it has the ability to sort of transcend not only into playgrounds, but also into mm-hmm. any public space, right?
Mm-hmm. I wonder, I mean, there's something in that observation that I think is important, in that, like, there's a real risk of a feedback loop if you're only drawing inspiration from your own kind of peers and what they're doing. So if I just looked at what other playground manufacturers were doing, especially in North America, then I would, of course, my view would narrow and the creativity would as well. And I think that's doesn't have to be a message just for like the play. That's landscape architects finding, I think, so the partners that I've worked with in landscape architecture that come to the table with like this piece of modern art really inspired me. That this is where the design is coming from. Those kind of creative folks are really onto something, and they're usually the most fun to work on. Mm. They're not just like trying to kind of perpetuate something that they saw one of their peers doing. They're really drawing inspiration from life, from art, from architecture, from there's so many places to draw inspiration from, and I think it's really important to actively seek that out.
I love that. I think that is really an expression of like when we're trying to be the creator, you know, it's like the capital C. It's just let me go ahead and just be the original thought, like bring in the original thought, bring in all of these ideas. And in reality, I think we forget that everything around us was really an original thought, and we're just taking inspiration from that and trying to, you know, bring that out into the world as designers. I think, yeah, it's if you're drawing inspiration from things that are inspiring, then we're able to, like, maybe there's a sense of humility there too, of like, oh yeah, like this didn't come from me, but I love it and I can make something out of it.
Yeah, it makes your mindset a little bit more like less of I need to find original thought. I need to be the original thought person.
Right.
And more about like, I'm in a conversation and I'm in a conversation with people that I haven't met. I'm in conversation with the spaces that they've created or the things that they've come up with, things that they've written or painted. Letting yourself be a little bit more of a collaborator with other people, whether human. They know it or not. Yeah. Human. I think that's really like the key. I think it's really dangerous to be obsessed with like being original, because I think it's really just everybody's kind of talking to each other and building on each other. And it's just like, I just want to add another layer. I just want to build just a little bit more.
Mm.
So.
Yeah, so true. Do you think that, you had mentioned this in, sort of in the beginning of like your interest in art history. I guess something that just kind of came to my mind was that, do you think that like back in the old paint, I don't know too much about art history, so please forgive me for sounding a little bit doi-doi when I'm talking about this, but like with art history and you look at all these old paintings, you tend to think Da Vinci, like the originator, you know, he is the one that was like originally did all these cool things and everyone's just trying to copy him. Do you think that's true? Or at least, do you think that maybe he even collaborated?
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think that he's a genius, and I think that a lot of the people that have sustained time are genius level, but that doesn't mean that they aren't a product of their context and you know, their culture and their peers and their struggles and all of those things. They didn't exist in a void. And I think that that's the thing to remember now for people is that, you know, we're in collaboration with our times and the needs of our time. We're in collaboration with you know, the creatives that are now and in the past. What I find is that the biggest moments in art history or design history are coming from people that really are able to articulate their beliefs. And by that, I'm not necessarily talking about like faith beliefs, but like what they believe is really important for society or for, for what beauty really, where that comes from. They're really in touch and are able to articulate something about their beliefs in a way and go all in to explore that idea. So I think right now there's the, you know, sustainability is one of those things that's really at the core of a lot of innovation, inclusion and diversity and those kinds of things are more present, I think, in at least our society than they have been in a long time. And I think people who really embrace that and strive for it, they're pursuing their belief in what is beautiful and what is right, that motivation is converting into innovation.
I think almost kind of like what you're describing is like a conviction.
That's like right.
Something yeah. that I it sounds very serious, I think, that term, but I think it's something that you believe in that is worth exploring to you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's also doesn't mean that it's not necessarily going to change, because I guess we live in a world that's constantly changing. Mm-hmm. Is finding that there's always going to be this big question mark, I think, as at least for students, like, what is that? Mm-hmm. What does that look like right now for me and for students who are trying to figure out, what is my conviction? What do I believe? Like, what do I like? You know, like that path is hard to find for someone who's never really had even much, maybe much life experience or even experience in general.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the journey that we have as students.
Be patient with yourself though. Mm.
Yeah, I'm not a patient person, so that's hard. Every time I hear that, I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
I'm like, patient, okay, you know. But yeah, it's very true. Mm-hmm. I have that's very, very true. Yeah. Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you for reaching out after that talk.
Yeah.
I appreciate making this connection and being able to chat with you today. It's really been lovely.
Yes, great. I'm so glad. That's always what we're trying to strive for and having good conversations, especially I think students will learn from professionals and people who are moving in the industry like yourself. So I think it's unique what you're doing, and I think not many people are I can have this sort of idea where it's like fun and serious, but also just mainly fun. so it's like, wow, I could have both if I wanted, you know? So, so it's great. Thanks so much, Nathan. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
I hope that you guys liked today's episode. Don't forget to leave us a rating and a review. Also, give us a follow on Instagram at The Greenside Pod and check out our new website at thegreensidepodcast.com. Stay tuned for our next Side Talks episode where we discuss our perspectives of this month's interview from the sidelines. This episode was edited by Patricia Fabregas. As always, keep hugging trees and stay on the green side.